Thanks for listening to the podcast. Stay connected on Facebook/ IFBB Ben PAK fan page, on Twitter at IFBB Ben PAK, and of course, BenPokulski.com.
What's up, everybody? Ben Pokulski in the house for another episode. I believe this is episode 16 of the Muscle Expert Podcast with the man, the legend himself, Dr. Jacob Wilson. What's up, brother?
Hey, Ben. It's great to be on the show, man. I'm real excited.
Yeah, man. Dude, you know, you work 3 blocks from where I live, and you and I need to do more stuff together, so I'm glad that we've both made the time, because obviously our schedules don't always permit to coordinate for an hour of just basically shooting the breeze about how to build bigger muscles, man. That's kind of what we do, right?
100%, Ben. I mean, just 24/7 trying to figure this all out, and it's great because a lot of times we have conversations with each other. It's like, I wish we could have put this on record, right?
So was it like last Wednesday? Was it Wednesday or Thursday? Dr. Wilson came by the MI40 gym, and we were just chatting about his new endeavors and my new endeavors, and there was probably like 7 of us standing around just literally talking about some of the most interesting and probably advanced topics with respect to hypertrophy that, you know, anyone on the planet is probably discussing, and we're just throwing them around like random conversation. It was pretty awesome. That's what stimulated this podcast, man. So, dude, I'm glad to have you back, and hopefully we can do this, ideally every week. It'd be great.
100%. Yeah. And, yeah, so I think because we were talking about such advanced topics, I think one of the things Ben and I talked about is we're going to be knocking out a lot of podcasts, weekly and stuff like that. So it'd be good to kind of just cover a lot of the basic tools that the bodybuilder should be concerned with every time they walk into the weight room.
There's so many things, whether you're a beginner, whether you're advanced, and I'm going to guess most of our listeners are probably relatively advanced. And I'm going to tell you, Doc, I get to travel a lot, and I probably get 100 emails a week. I probably get, every time I'm at a show, an expo, anywhere, I get hundreds upon hundreds of people that say, dude, when are you doing your podcast again? When are you and Dr. Wilson going to start that podcast again? And I'm like, I'm going to do it, I promise. So, man, there's a need, there's a desire out there, man, which is amazing. So I'm glad people are liking it, and that motivates me in itself. So let's keep doing awesome stuff together, man.
100%, Ben, 100%. And on this topic's really cool, and it's basically like, it's called acute training variables, which is basically like the variables or the training methods you use every time you go in the weight room.
Yep.
So what we're talking about is basically like a lot of the basics, like for example, how many repetitions should you do? How many sets? What should your volume be? You know, how long should I rest between sets? Should I use isolation exercises? How should I order exercises? And so I think so that's kind of what we're going to get into today. And I was thinking, why not just go ahead and talk about intensity and repetition from start?
Yeah, man. And, I drill home, like, my biggest topic of discussion and topic of education from my followers is always execution, 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 because I really believe that without intelligent and proper execution, everything else doesn't necessarily matter so much. And that's kind of where our conversation went last time, was the idea that, all these EMG studies that people are putting out saying that this exercise recruits more of that muscle, and, when you do it this way, it recruits more of that muscle. It's all completely useless, because you can massively change your muscle recruitment based on what your focus is, based on what joint moves first, based on so many different variables. And I'm so focused on drilling home execution that sometimes I overlook, or at least I don't necessarily spend a lot of time instructing people on repetition, sets, volume, rest lengths, things like that. And I'd love to get into an intelligent discussion with you about it, man, because I think there's obviously a huge need for it. And, I spent so much time talking about execution. I think the next step for everybody is once you've nailed that execution, okay, well, now let's put together an intelligent program. So nobody better to talk to you than you.
Oh, 100%, Ben. Actually, it's pretty cool, you talking about that, because, if the goal is for a bodybuilder is to activate as much of the target tissue as possible, the majority of things they do is thinking that the only way to do that is just the weight that you select. And in reality, you could be so skilled at a movement, you know, like a squat, for example, that you could easily squat and barely recruit your quads and lift a ton of weight, you know. And I think that's the main point is, like, basically that when we talk about intensity, a lot of it is relative to what you point out, the intent or the focus and the execution of the lift itself first.
Yeah,
I think that's
exactly. You know, yeah, that's the argument, right? And this is something that most people need clarity on and why I try to drill it home as often as possible is, you know, if you pick up a 100-pound dumbbell or a 100-pound barbell or whatever it may be and do, let's say we're doing a bench press, and then you put on 110 pounds, and you assume that because you're using 110 pounds that your chest is doing more work, you're actually very much wrong. It's not necessarily the case. It may get a smaller, tiny bit incrementally more load, but it actually may not get any more load at all. You know, your ancillary muscles may actually get more load. Someone may be tricep dominant. Someone may be protracted in their posture, and that completely negates any additional benefit for the pec. So by arbitrarily adding load, it doesn't necessarily guarantee that you're going to increase the amount of load or electrical activity in that muscle. And that's really important to notice or to realize. And that's why I'm so adamant about execution first. You know, it has to be execution first.
Yeah, 100%. And it's funny because I remember actually, it was a few years ago, we did the study in our lab on your new on your newest MI40, the Extreme protocol, and we had some monsters and really big guys in the lab, and they would go, well, hey, you know, you might have had a set of 10 or something on bench press, and like, hey, well, I'm gonna go ahead, I'll put 315 on there, I'm a monster. And when you actually showed them the execution, some of these guys were going to failure at 10 reps of 185. And, you know, and literally shaking while they were doing it. And they had never experienced that before. And, you know, because what you were doing was placing the tension on the chest itself. So the first thing I want to say is, like, when we talk about repetitions and we talk about, you know, say for bodybuilding, one of the sweet spots might be 8 to 12 repetitions for just a general sweet spot. A lot of times viewers will also like the weight I could do that. Must be like 250. But in reality, you could do it just to lift the weight, and you might not get barely any pec growth, or you could actually do it with intent, in which case your 8 to 12 repetition maximum drastically changes.
Right. Yeah, and it's the simple necessity of differentiating your goal, right? If I'm trying to build muscle, this is the way I want to do it. If I'm trying to get strong, this is the way I want to do it. And it's important to differentiate that, man, because moving weight is never the goal, right? It's aggressively contracting muscle against load. And that's one of the things I often say in my camps is, you know, pay attention to the idea that this is, I either say it's mindful contracting of muscle against the load or aggressive contraction of muscle against the load, you know, both of which are equally as effective and true, but that's really what muscle building is, right? It's not, well, I want to move this weight. It's, no, I want to aggressively contract this muscle and have a load to push against in order to increase the amount of aggression of contraction effectively, right?
100%. And it's real interesting, too, because when you look at, like, sports, you know, we talk about, let's say you think about basketball, you talk about specificity. Everything you do should be specific to improving your shot, to improving your vertical jump. But when you're talking about bodybuilding and building a physique, the lifting is not – it shouldn't be specific to lifting the weight. It should be specific to targeting the muscle. And I was talking yesterday we have Dr. Carlos Ugrinowicz has just joined our lab. He's one of the top experts in the world at integrating, like, mechanics with physiology. He actually reminds me a lot of you, Ben, and a lot of the stuff you talk about. And one thing I was talking to him about, the intent process that you use, and when you do a bench press, how you're pulling in on the bar. And he goes, well – and I said, well, you know, it's really effective. What do you think's going on? He goes, well, a lot of it makes – he goes, it makes sense in the sense if you think about specificity, you think about Ben going on stage or a bodybuilder going on stage and they're doing a most muscular, where are they going to want that force to be executed, right? And if you look at that, that's actually most specific to the pecs. It's most specific to actually flexing the muscle itself. It's actually creating a skill of being able to execute that skill on stage even better. So it's not just activating the muscle better, but it's allowing you to more fully contract it and display it when you actually go on stage.
Yeah, I mean, that's essentially it. And effectively, the way I like to explain it is, it's just directing the load. It's directing the tension. So let's give a brief 20-second example. If I'm doing a bench press with 300 pounds or 200 pounds, the number is arbitrary, and my joints are stacked, so my wrists, my elbows, my shoulders are stacked, the load is going to disperse itself through the joint. If I now mindfully pull my hands toward each other, all I'm doing is directing the load, or the tension, rather, more internal, so more into the muscles inside of the axis. So now if I mindfully pull my hands apart, all I'm doing now is directing more of the tension to the outside of the axis. So now into my triceps, rear delts, mid-back, rhomboids, et cetera. And if time under tension is one of the biggest correlates of growth and muscle damage, doesn't it just make sense that by shifting that focus just a little bit, I change the amount of time under tension for that particular musculature? Of course, my body's going to have a natural tendency to put tension where it wants it to go. But if I can just preference it a little bit, maybe I can't preference it 100%, but if I can just preference it a little bit in one direction or the other, I'm increasing the amount of overall tension, the overall time under tension for the muscles that I'm trying to target. And it's so simple, but it's just so logical, right? If you break it down in a way that you're like, oh, you know, that just makes sense. If I'm trying to work these muscles, why not just put them under tension or load for a little bit longer than if you weren't to do this?
100%. And it's also, I think, logical to understand that the body, like you point out, is going to want to put the tension where it wants to, which is going to be the most efficient way to actually take tension off of the muscle and just distribute it overall, so there's less damage overall and less growth overall.
Yep, exactly. And it's always going to tend to use the biggest muscles, which are your strengths. And if you're trying to develop your weaknesses, you're going to run into some problems.
100%. Now, once you execute, and I think one of the biggest things that I think we see, I know that we saw it in the study we did with you, is initially when people were switching over to the execution, you know, initially their weights went down, but then as they adapted and they learned the skill, they started to get stronger within proper execution. And once you do that, I think one thing I want to kind of address a little bit is once you have proper execution, certain repetition ranges, and I think it's important to understand that, like, there's different repetition ranges are going to have different goals overall. So, you know, like, one of the sweet spots is a lot of times bodybuilders are trying to maximize the pump. They're trying to maximize things like metabolic stress, like lactic acid. And to do that, you're talking about getting a tension that's probably going to be anywhere from 30 to 60 seconds, which is probably going to be anywhere from 8 to 12 repetitions, or if need be, carrying that out to like a superset or a giant set. So I think that when we're talking about maximizing metabolic stress, those growth mechanisms, probably around 8 to 12 repetitions. But
that's right.
I know that also one thing you do, Ben, is you do recommend periodizing, where you do have some days where you're focusing more and more the mechanical stress, and I've seen you use more of the heavier loading, like 6 repetitions and things like that.
Absolutely, man. I mean, someone at my level who, you know, for the most part, my execution is pretty darn great. Now is the time when these variables become most important to manipulate, right? For average people, I see very little, maybe not very little need, but minimal need to manipulate variables of effort until they get execution right. And then once you've nailed the execution, it's absolutely essential because, I mean, those are the only things that are going to change. Every rep looks exactly the same. Every set looks exactly the same. So your body's going to be adapted very, very quickly. So you better change your periodization, your sets and reps often if you want to continue progressing.
100%. And sort of speaking of that, like once So that's the first thing I would say. For those listening, you know, execution, and then you can manipulate the reps. So you're talking about 8 to 12 repetitions. That's your maximum pump. That's your maximum metabolic stress. Probably a sweet spot for bodybuilding. Or so you're talking about anywhere from, I really don't know why bodybuilders are really focused a lot on doing sets of one much, but I think when you're talking about like 4 to 6 repetitions is probably like really good for mechanical stress and damage. So I think those are sort of a good rep range for that. But after that, one of the biggest question marks that we have, I know, in science, and literally I was in the lab yesterday, I must have had like a 3-4 hour conversation with the guys in the lab, is what about volume? You know, and meaning like how many sets are you doing in a workout? And that becomes very difficult. One thing we've looked at is, one thing we know from the literature is, like, you have these camps, which are more like the high-intensity training, where it's like one set is all you need once per week. But one thing I do know is, looking at the studies, I think it's pretty clear that multiple sets are likely going to, unless you're, like, backing off training and trying to just purely recover, multiple sets are generally going to always be better than, for growth anyway, for making gains, than just doing one set. And when I mean one set, I'm not talking about a giant set. I mean literally like one set once every 7 to 10 days. Multiple sets right. are likely going to be a lot better than that.
Now, let me ask you this, Doc. This is something that I love your opinion on. This is one of the questions that I kind of had that I wanted to throw at you today, was, are you aware of any research or do you have any opinion on strategically varying volume based on the size of the body part? So, obviously, larger body parts, quads, glutes, lats, pecs even, perhaps. You could argue either way for that. Is there a greater need for higher amounts of reps, a greater need for higher amounts of sets, volume? Any opinions there in either direction?
Great question. So I'll tell you what, it really all depends, because here's the thing. If you have a guy, all of us have body parts that respond better than others. And so, for example, you may have a guy or a girl whose legs respond tremendously to training, and then, you know, they have a hard time, for example, maybe getting their shoulders to grow. So what ends up happening is that their legs, you know, they could actually train at lower volume on their legs and get massive gains. But the only thing that responds, even though their shoulders are relatively smaller, the only way to get them to grow is to blast them with high volume. And so what ends up happening is, it's possible that under those conditions, the shoulders may need more volume than the leg, and the advantage to that could be that the legs can continue to grow with lower volume, but you can spend more effort on the weak point with higher volume. However, the thing is, oftentimes what happens is that a lot of times guys will venture to move toward the body part that grows the most. And so they'll go, okay, this body part's growing the most, so they hit it with the most volume. And therefore, because it's more conditioned than every other body part, then you might need to do more to get it to grow. So I would say it would depend on the situation that the athlete finds himself in. If they blasted a body part with everything they can and it's not growing anymore, and that's why it's also larger because they spent more attention on it, yeah, it might either need more volume or it might need more variation. If it's just a body part that just won't respond to lower volume, even though it's smaller, it might need more volume than the larger body part.
That's the typical paradigm, and that's a typical answer that most people are going to give when it comes to weak body parts. But, man, I'll tell you what, from my opinion and my observation, I've never seen a single person who has a weak body part that executes movements properly. So, you know, the argument is, you know, if you're doing something right, have you ever seen someone who's got, a really poorly developed muscle group yet executes it perfectly and has always executed perfectly? I haven't. If some body part sucks in someone, it's because their execution usually sucks. Conversely, if someone's got a great body part, most of the time, and not always, sometimes you have the freaks of nature who can grow doing absolutely anything. Most of the time, if someone has a great body part, it's because their execution is great. And oftentimes it's just natural. They don't think about it. They just, their body just knows how to move properly. Their lever lengths are right, whatever it may be. It just set, their body is set up to develop X and Y body parts. Whereas they may not be set up naturally and genetically to develop the other body part, but you can manipulate that, right? You can manipulate that. And okay, so instead of just hammering it with more, you know, that's always kind of my point is the solution when somebody says, well, you know, you have weak delts, just train them more. You need to train them 3 times a week. Bullshit, man. You don't need to train them 3 times. Maybe you need to train them 3 times a week, but you need to learn to train them properly first. And then let's try to train them 3 times a week so that we can have more of a, you know, an increased frequency effect, but with proper form. Just throwing more shitty form in it doesn't ever make it better. It just usually causes injuries, right? So
100%.
You know, that's always the argument. It's like, you know, instead of saying, well, just throw more volume at it, let's make it feel right first. You know, I can't think of a single person I've ever seen who has a poorly developed body part yet executes an exercise perfectly. So
that's just one thing, actually. Yeah, that's one thing Ryan, like, so Ryan Lowry in our lab, that's one of his major theories as well. He actually thinks, that you, and I think, you know, it is what you've seen as well. His whole thought is that people who have better developed body parts have a greater ability to activate them during the execution of any movement. And he thinks that's a large reason of why those body parts are growing more than others. And I would, you know, I think that there's a, I think there's definitely, especially what we're seeing in our lab with muscle activation, I think that's definitely true. So
it's
again,
not,
I think
I don't think it's from a perspective of some anomaly reason as to why they just can feel it better. It's an anatomical observation that says, hey, this guy develops his biceps well because he has the proper lever lengths, the proper insertion of the muscle, and probably has a good degree of natural external rotation of the glenohumeral joint, so he stays in an appropriate plane for recruiting his biceps. Where you have a guy who has poorly developed biceps, his shoulders are probably protracted, he's probably slightly internally rotated at the glenohumeral joint, and he never gets any degree of external rotation and supination because he can't get there. So his butt doesn't maintain tension in his biceps. You know, it's usually a mechanical thing as to why people have poorly developed body parts. And you can change that, right? You can change mechanics by changing the way people execute movement. And obviously you can't change lever lengths, things like that, but you can certainly change the orientation of your humerus. You can certainly change the orientation of your pelvis, you know, things like that, which massively influence recruitment of muscles.
100%. And I think that's where it goes back to the fact that when you're talking about bodybuilding itself, if you're looking at, like, again, most people think, I'm going to do squat. They're thinking, I'm trying to master the squat. I'm trying to lift weights. But in reality, with bodybuilding, the skill is I'm using this exercise as a tool to activate X muscle or Y muscle.
Sure.
And it's a totally different perspective. So
yeah,
I 100% agree
with
that.
Yeah, it's kind of the analogy of, you know, I'm trying to lose body fat, so I'm going to walk an hour on the treadmill. Well, no, you're not going to walk an hour on the treadmill. Your goal is to lose fat. Your goal isn't to walk an hour on the treadmill. So, you know, why walk an hour on the treadmill if you can get the same result in 20 minutes? Wouldn't it make sense to do 20 minutes? The same idea. Like, your goal isn't to squat. Your goal, I mean, unless your goal is to squat. Like, if your goal is to be a powerlifter, your goal is to squat. Your goal is to squat. But if your goal is to build a muscle, your goal isn't to squat 500 pounds. It should never be to squat 500 pounds. It should be to increase your body's ability, your nervous system, and your brain's ability to recruit and contract that muscle so that you get greater hypertrophy and greater stimulus via more tension, more contraction.
100%. No question about it. And once you... And once you get that execution, then volume just becomes another tool, you know, that you could utilize. I think, like you point out, I think volume is something that can be manipulated. I think everyone is always out to say, well, what is that magical number of sets that I need to do to grow? And I don't know if there's a magical number of sets that you need to grow. I think that it comes down to, first off, there's not been a ton of studies on, like, how many sets do I need to do? But if we say, well, someone gets to the point where they're executing, what studies do we have out there? Well, most of the studies we have out there will compare, like, 3 sets versus 1 set. 3 sets are better than 1. we have, interestingly enough, we have Carlos Ugrinowicz in our labs doing research where he compared 5 versus 10 sets on leg. This is like squats and leg press versus 15. But you got to remember, these people, they're strong people, like squatting more for a study especially. They're squatting over 2 times their body weight.
Right.
And they're, but basically these guys, they're having to do 5, 10, 15 sets, and but they're doing it every time they work out, every single
right.
time. And what he's finding is like, well, 10 ends up being better than 5, but 15, you're going the other way. But the main thing that we talked about yesterday is that if you're doing 15, if you're doing it really hard, you're executing things right. 15 sets can be a lot on legs, but if you're doing every set all out, because they're going to failure on every set. But I think what happens is that if you're doing the same super high volume every single workout without periodizing, you're probably going to stop making gains. So I think there is a need to vary that volume. So maybe high volume days, certainly 5 sets is probably going to be better than 1. 10 could be better than 5, but bottom line is that if you're going to go high volume days, you're going to need to periodize that. Maybe some days very high volume, some days lower volume, some days moderate volume.
Then there's also the consideration of how well does that exercise that you're choosing match the strength curve, match the resistance profile that your body's able to generate, right? So, or match your body's strength profile. So if you're doing an exercise that has a terrible strength profile, your overall fatigue will be less. Your overall stimulus to the muscle will be less. Whereas if you're doing something that appropriately matches your body's ability to generate force, your overall fatigue will be much greater. And so to explain that to people in a way that's really easy to understand is at any point in a movement, your body has a differing capacity to generate force. So at the lengthened and shortened part of the range, it's weaker. In the middle part of the range, it's stronger. So some exercises really effectively match your body's ability to generate force, and some exercises are complete opposite and are really, really poor choices. So if one part of the exercise is really heavy, another part is really, really light. So during that part that's light, obviously you're not putting a tremendous amount of effort into the exercise. So, you know, 8 sets of an exercise that really, really matches the strength curve well versus an exercise that doesn't match the strength curve well could be a completely different result. And, you know, simply differentiating an execution in a squat or, you know, differing lever lengths could massively change someone's ability to match a strength curve. So if someone doesn't go all the way up or, you know, there's so many different variables, man, that it's exercise is such a fascinating thing because I don't know that we're ever going to come to the answer. It's almost like, you know, nutrition and the fact that the only person that matters is that is you, you know, like, well, what works for me, and this is what works for me. And, you know, exercise is physics, so you can't refuse that, but so many different variables that, you know, the studies just need to get so extensive.
100%, and that's the thing. And I remember talking to you, I came to the MI40 gym just last week, and one of the things is, I know a lot of times you've talked about sort of mastering these strength curves. It's kind of just to give these guys like a picture of what you're talking about. Let's say you're doing a bench press, obviously, and you're limited. Once, you know, the first half of the movement might be hard. Once you get past that sticking point, you're basically just riding momentum the way up. And what we see in the literature is like once you get past that sticking point, you're decelerating. Force output is lower, right, during that second half. And your muscle activation is actually during the second half of the activity. So first half, it's going up and up. Once you get past the sticking point, muscle activation is going down and down and down. So what does that mean? What's the only part of the lift that's benefiting you at all? It's really all the way up to the sticking point, and then you're getting no more adaptation out of that. So when I went to Ben's gym last week, it's really cool because, like, Ben's obviously, you've been all around the world, trained at all the different gyms around, you know, all around the globe, and looked at different techniques and different equipment. So what it's sick because Ben's got inside of his gym all of these pieces of equipment that literally match your strength curve. And I know one thing you talked about with your workout is you're able to now in the MI40 gym get workouts that might be 30 to 45 minutes that before might have taken you 2 hours without having that proper equipment to match the strength curve.
Yeah, that's exactly it, man. I mean, where before I would have to do two or three exercises, now I can do the same amount of work in one exercise by, you know, just matching what my body is able to do, you know. So there's never a point, of wasted time during any set, or most sets and most exercises. You know, every inch of that rep, my body is working as hard as it possibly can. You know, to think about that, you know, those people at home, imagine being able to work to perfectly match what your body's able to do at every second during that rep and that set. Massively valuable, right? Like, and then, you know, instead of doing 20 sets for this body part, I just did 6 and I'm toast because my body has nothing left in it. That's where you may make an argument for doing something like HIIT training, because, you know, I could pick 4 different exercises and I'm destroyed because every muscle fiber is completely exhausted and fatigued because it never got a chance to relax. So, you know, it seems like that's the future of muscle building.
Is that so? Maybe the point is that while volume is certainly an important variable, your volume is basically going to be dictated by the efficiency of the movement itself and its ability to match the strength curve, which means that if you are able to match that, then maybe your volume gets cut in half or even a third in some cases.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'll tell you what, I mean, I've noticed some of my hardest leg workouts to now be 35 to 40 minutes, and that's, you know, compared to what I used to do in 2 hours. Anyway, man, I want to talk to you. Is any studies out there? Like, I want people are interested in studies and seeing what people are studying out there. Any current studies? I know you've got a couple listed here on our notes. Any current studies based on repetitions? Anything you want to talk about on, you know, sets and reps and volume and stuff like that? Any particular studies worth mentioning?
Yeah. So I think the main thing, you know, if you look again, one of the things that for bodybuilders, they want to maximize a load that causes tension, but they also want to maximize the metabolic stress of the workout itself. Mm-hmm. And it's important to differentiate between sort of powerlifting and bodybuilding. They're different sports. And so, again, you're maximizing the pump and the metabolic stress. So one of the main studies that that's famous out there, or two main studies, is one was by Häkkinen, and he's from Finland, and he's done more strength training studies than anyone in the history of science. And he compared a bodybuilding routine, where it's like more sets of 10, to more powerlifting routine, closer to sets of 1. But basically what he found is way far greater metabolic stress, much greater anabolic response with the more of the 10 repetition range. And also, another good friend of mine, Yuha Holmi, looked at like actually anabolic signaling, and he compared more of a bodybuilding routine, which was like 5 sets of 10, to more of a powerlifting routine, which is like 1 to 5 reps. And you see more anabolic signaling, like more protein sensitive signaling in the muscle. So what this sort of tells me is that, again, your sweet spot is probably going to be a little bit higher of a repetition range where you're getting a pump, where you're getting metabolic stress. But again, you know, you're using those heavier rep days as sort of a tool, and you're periodizing them into your training. But I wouldn't think that someone who just says, well, let me just focus on getting stronger. I'm just going to power lift in a 1 to 5 rep range, and that's going to optimize my body composition. Well, it does add muscle. I don't think, and there's a lot of research supports, I don't think that's ideal in itself for gaining muscle as far as repetition range.
Huh, interesting, man. I'd love to hear, why don't you give a little bit greater explanation as to what exactly you mean by anabolic signaling. So is it just mTOR? And let's first start with that, and then I'd like to just talk about, you know, what specifics, is there something specific that someone can look for tangibly that may indicate that there's some anabolic signaling going on?
Yeah, so basically, a couple things. The three different things that we're really looking for to indicate that you've gotten a stimulus to grow. And we've looked at this where we've literally taken individual cells into a lab and stimulated them this way, or done it in whole body. And we've seen this three major things, or actually really four major things. The four major things are that you need to get metabolic stress. What that is that's that burning sensation that people are feeling in the muscle. A lot of that is lactate. That burning sensation you get in the muscle is a lactate, and that is what we call metabolic stress. We know if you take a cell in isolation, you bathe it in lactate, it actually stimulates protein synthesis. And that was research by my good friend David Dunderman. So that will be the indication. When you feel that pain, that burning sensation, that's that. So a lot of times when people feel that, they back off. They'll sort of rest pause. And it's important to realize that as that sensation is increasing, that's stimulating growth. And so when you sort of hesitate, you're getting that pain, like, I can't do this anymore, you're going to likely need to push past that to push past certain barriers. The other thing I would say is the swelling response, so that's your pump, and it basically the more of a pump you get, the swelling response, we know triggers certain growth factors. So that is important. So that's going to be dictated, one, by your repetition range. It's going to be dictated. A lot of times, you pointed out, like when people aren't growing, they're not executing things right, and they're almost like, I can't get, like they might go, say your delts don't grow. I can't get a pump on my delts no matter what I do. Part of focusing on tension is directing that tension towards the muscle. You just might not be activating the tissue itself, so you're not getting a pump. But again, when you build up metabolites in your muscle, it will draw fluid into the cell, right, and that's going to give you the pump response that you get. The other thing is that you talk a lot about this, Ben, is that obviously nutrition and hydration are going to be a large factor in that as well. So you could execute the movement correctly, but if the nutrients aren't there in the tissue, if you're dehydrated, there's actually studies where if you're dehydrated, going into training, the coolest thing, or not cool, but the craziest, one of the craziest data pieces I've seen is most people walking into a gym are already dehydrated before they even start training.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's limiting the pump that they're going to get. And then the next thing is basically being able to actually get some damage, some soreness. And I know, like, for example, like when guys do MI40 or something like that, what I've seen, what we saw in the lab is people were sore, especially initially. And that a lot of that is basically saying, well, that's muscle damage itself. So that will trigger a growth response. So I'd say those are three ways. And the last way is basically you're recruiting those fast-twitch muscle fibers. And there's two ways to do that. One is tension. The more tension on the muscle, the more tension demands on the muscle, the more you're going to activate the fast-twitch muscle fibers. And the other way is basically fatigue itself. So if it's hard on rep 8 and you kind of quit when you really could get 12, you won't ultimately activate those larger fast-twitch muscle fibers to a great enough extent.
And just to kind of briefly touch on what you said there about, you know, weak body parts and people saying I can't feel the muscle or I can't get a pump or whatever it is, it's because typically when you do something right and you actually use your muscles to move a load, it hurts. It starts to burn. So people stop, and their body's looking for a way to cheat. And I find that so common, man. They do two or three reps well, and then all of a sudden on the fourth and fifth rep, they start to cheat because their body's starting to sense a little bit of discomfort, or maybe it's their brain sensing a little bit of discomfort, and they're looking for a solution to avoid it. It's really funny. So then, you know, obviously some of it's conscious, some of it's unconscious. Your body trying to unconsciously avoid that. And that's why I think it's so important to have, you know, what I call a primer phase to relearn motor patterns, man, to relearn motor angles so that you're breaking bad habits, so that when you reach unconscious competence for execution of movements where you don't have to think about it and your body just naturally knows how to do it, that's when the greatest potential for growth comes, right? Is, you know, it's just like anything in life. Once it's a habit, it's easy. So if you can figure out a way to create these proper movement patterns and as a habit, you know, your muscle building endeavors are going to be so much easier. So you got to stop reinforcing the poor movement pattern habits, cheating, you know, just trying to finish reps unnecessarily with poor form. Such a terrible habit people take on, you know. So one thing I want to kind of open the loop here for, man, is lactic acid, because it's such an interesting topic, and you briefly brought that up. I'd like to actually make that the topic of one of our next podcasts, if you're interested in that. Because I think, you know, people hear that term, and there's a lot of misunderstanding, and there's a lot of uncertainty, and I'd love to get some clarity on that, man. I'd love to offer, you know, maybe a 30-minute podcast or maybe half of a podcast just to talking about the function, the benefit, the mechanism of lactic acid and how much it influences growth, body composition, and the whole hypertrophy response.
Oh, absolutely. I think that's going to be a great topic. It definitely could be a podcast of its own, for sure.
Awesome. Awesome. So, yeah, man, I don't know if you want to, when you finish off here with, you know, maybe a minute talking about how lactic acid affects our body, what it actually does, and then we can lead into our next podcast and entice people to come back and listen to us next time. So, you know, tell them just a few of the basic things, things it affects, just kind of open their minds to what we're going to talk about next time.
Perfect. All right. So basically, for you guys who are listening out there, girls who are listening out there, you want to think about, like, what is lactic acid? Basically, when we train under high-intensity conditions, our main source of fuel is carbohydrates, it's glucose. Really, we store glucose in the muscle as glycogen. It's just basically, like, that's just how we store, like, glucose in the cell. And what happens is we break it down under high-intensity conditions, and basically when you're using very high intensity, you can't completely use the carbohydrate via aerobic pathways. And so what happens is it gets converted via an anaerobic pathway, meaning like without oxygen, to lactic acid. And basically, you know, as the name suggests, it is an acid. But the cool thing is that lactic acid basically causes a buildup of certain metabolic byproducts in the cell that actually trigger the cell to grow. And that's a really cool thing. And on the next podcast, we'll get into more of like what are those sort of molecular pathways that it's actually triggering. But so that's kind of the way. What happens is under anaerobic conditions or like high-intensity conditions where the aerobic system can't keep pace with the movement, you form lactic acid, and that causes a buildup of byproducts that trigger growth. And it's actually a phenomenal way. And so what we're going to talk about, I'll say in the next podcast, is, well, how do we maximize that response? And why does lactic acid actually work? What are those molecular pathways?
Awesome. So, yeah, you'll talk about the mechanisms and how it works, and I'm going to bring to the table some of my best tools for maximizing lactic acid, some of my best protocols, some of the little tricks and tips that I use with myself and with my high-end clients to accelerate results and make it hurt just that little bit extra to know that you worked hard today.
Yeah.
So, man, Doc, you know, that's it for that, man. I want to wrap it up by telling everybody what's going on with you, what you got, you know, in the funnel, what's going on for you coming up the next few weeks.
Yeah, absolutely. So, well, right now our lab's working real ferociously on a bunch of different variables. One of the studies we're doing this semester, and we'll let you guys know the results on this podcast once we find it out, is we're actually looking at all the major training variables, the shocking principles. You know, like you go all the way back to the old school principles like supersets, like drop sets, like strip sets, and failure training. And one of the things is, like, we know these are good tools. We don't have a ton of studies on them, especially comparing each of these tools to each other. So what we're going to be able to tell you after this semester is, okay, if I use failure training, here's the benefit, but then here's the recovery time that I'm going to need to recover from that. So I know that it might serve this anabolic stimulus, but also here's a repercussion. So, for example, if it's helpful, what are the recovery demands compared to traditional training? So we're going to compare supersets, drop sets, and one of the things we're going to compare is more like even sort of isometric contractions between sets, sort of meaning like flexing the muscle between sets. what effect does that have on growth? So that's one of the major studies that we're doing, and so we'll keep you guys posted on that. We're also doing a lot more on ketogenic dieting. One of the major problems people have with ketogenic dieting is it's too hard to adapt. They never get to the adaptation stage. So we're looking at Ryan Lowry in my lab, and another guy, Chris Irvin. Chris Irvin and Ryan Lowry are looking at how can we speed adaptation to ketogenic diet, and they're looking at different protocols to deplete glycogen faster. Will that drive you into ketosis faster? And then they're looking at what truly is keto adaptation and what could you do at home to know that you're keto adapted. So they're testing a bunch of different protocols to find out what that actually is. So those are the things we're working on. You guys are going to be able to hear that first before anyone else.
That's awesome, man. And as far as myself, it's 23 weeks from now, classic. I've canceled all my trips. I'm sitting on my ass, and I'm starting my training for the next 23 weeks. Man, I love training again. I love being at the gym. It gives my family a place, my kids a place to go. Slowly building my business. I'm loving shooting videos every day from my MI40 Nation site. Tons of new execution stuff. And literally, it's probably at least an hour a day where myself and my five top trainers sit around and talk intelligent training principles. And every Friday, we have a staff meeting where two of the junior trainers are teaching us something. So each week, they have to go and research some topic that's a little bit obscure and bring it back to us and speak to us as though they're an expert on it. So they've got 7 days to become an expert on a topic, which is obviously not easy to do, but they're literally reading everything they can 24 hours a day and taking notes, and they're working in teams so they can help each other, and kind of a cool environment, you know? So really excited, man. I think there's nobody else on the planet doing what we're doing as far as pushing the level of intelligent muscle building up. Which is why, Doc, I think it's a perfect tandem that you and I team up and knock out this Muscle Expert podcast once a week and give people insights on what we're doing. They got to learn, man. We got to teach it. We got to spread the knowledge, because there's no point in sitting around learning all this stuff and not sharing it with the world. So,
100%, Doc,
keep doing great things, man. And let's hook up and do some more things in the gym and in the future.
Right on, Ben. And great talking to you guys. And we'll see you next week.
Alrighty.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. Stay connected on Facebook / IFBB Ben PAK fan page, on Twitter @ IFBB Ben PAK, and of course, BenPakulski.com.